You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Muriel Wilkins is the founder and CEO of Paravis Partners. Did I say that right?
Paravis.
I said it wrong. But we're leaving it in. Paravis Partners, and a sought-after C-suite advisor and executive coach with a 20-year track record of helping senior leaders take their performance to the next level. She has served clients across a number of industries, including management consulting, private equity, biotech, financial services, retail, and nonprofits. She is the co-author of Own the Room, Discover Your Signature Voice to Master Your Leadership Presence. Muriel is the host of the award-winning Harvard Business Review podcast, Coaching Real Leaders. And her latest book is called Leadership Unblocked, Break Through the Beliefs That Limit Your Potential. You're going to enjoy the pod. Muriel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly. I am so delighted to be here.
There are many things I loved in this book, but one of the important takeaways is that none of us are immune to any of these hidden blockers, and that includes the author of this book.
That is absolutely 100% correct.
I love it. It's like every chapter, you're like, well, this is the phenomenon. Oh, by the way. And as what I hope I am as a generous reader, I saw myself in every one of these, like, oh,
yeah.
I've done that.
Yeah. I mean, Kelly, I will be honest, because I don't know how else to be. When I first sat down to write this book, very reluctantly, by the way, I thought, okay, I have two of these, like, I pretty much knew. Two of these are me, right? They're going to be my story. And I literally wrote this book between 4 and 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And after I would finish every chapter, I would like put my hand down, you know, press the last save. And then I would say, oh, damn, like I have this one too. So it actually was like a very cathartic process for myself to work through this book. Like I felt like I was not only working through with my clients and obviously wanting to help readers, but it helped me tremendously to actually work through it and process through each of these beliefs and how they've impacted me as well.
I gave a keynote this morning in like Itasca, Illinois. I don't even know where I was. I had someone drive me. But one of the things I was talking about, and these were like bioscientists. They're horticulture and other things, mm-hmm. but they asked a lot of really great questions, and one of them was like, we get all the sort of improv stuff you're telling us that can help you be a better collaborator, and, you know, but like, how do you do it in the room? And I was like, you start by being just eternally curious and enter the room thinking, and it's accurate, you probably have it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I was seeing in all these stories, and we'll get into some of the specific individuals that in the composites that you talk about in the book, but like, all of us have been that person who, like, I know the answer to this, and it's often too late when you discover you didn't.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I, you know, probably one of the things that if you had asked me 10 years ago, I would have had a different perspective on it, where I would have been like, yeah, everybody sort of thinks they're right and they're not. Shame on you. And my newer perspective is, you know, let's, like, cut ourselves some slack.
Yeah.
And give each other some grace, because it's no wonder we all sort of fight to be right. You know, it's a learned belief and behavior. That's how we were raised. You know, at least I was raised, but and certainly by the time you get to school, you're rewarded for being right. So why not walk around acting like you're right? You know, who doesn't want to be right when that's how the world, at least back then, when you were younger, deems you as worthy and valuable.
You note early in the book in the introduction that you want to be clear that coaching is not a substitute for therapy.
Yeah.
And this is a book about coaching, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm reading some subtext that maybe a little therapy is good for everyone too.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a big fan of doing both.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I am, you know, I kind of get on my soapbox a little bit about this, even though I'm in the profession of coaching, I stand 10 toes strong for the therapist, because if the belief that you are holding on to or that is getting in your way is deeply rooted in trauma, or it's one that you can't, through some of the simple exercises that I share, get past, then you know what, my friend, a coach is not the one to help you. Go to a licensed mental health professional. And so I often have clients where, not often, but I've had situations with clients where we sort of figure out that it's probably best for them to do therapy in lieu of coaching and or alongside of it, right? I think therapy is very much a healing profession. I don't see coaching as a healing profession. I see coaching as a planning profession. Let's figure out where you want to go, and then let's peel back the onion and figure out what steps to take in order for you to be able to get there.
I just had this thought, because I didn't put it together when I was reading the book, but I remember I never had any coaching. I was doing a talk. It wasn't a TED talk, but it was like that, the format mm-hmm. of that. And everyone got a coach. And I was sort of reluctant to be coached because mm-hmm. I was like, I speak a lot. And one of my colleagues who knew they had permission to make fun of me for this was like, oh, you have nothing to learn from anyone. And I was surprised about how I took to the coaching. And then I was in therapy, which was great. Mm-hmm. And I will say this, the therapy made me more coachable. I don't know if
and
that's...
And why is that, Kelly?
I suspect that I was now in a place where I could be much more honest with myself about mm-hmm. what were the sort of my own beliefs, blocks, blind spots, call it what you will, mm-hmm. heuristics, the knowledge of like, oh yeah, I was probably doing that because of this. And so when I did get some coaching fairly late in my career, mm-hmm. it was just a complete gift, because I could walk in and mm-hmm. be like, I'm sitting here raw. Like,
yeah.
Like it was COVID. It was George Floyd. I mm-hmm. work at an institution, a very white institution that did mm-hmm. not escape that whole, you know, thing. And really had to, the thing I talk about a lot is the reckoning I had to come face to face with in an industry that used to say, you know, the show must go on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then realizing yeah. that was an oppressive tool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was hard, but
yeah.
but again, all those elements was like, okay, let's take that information now. How do we apply it inside the workplace that exists today?
Right. Exactly. And so I think with coaching, it takes you from where you are now. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's informed by the past, but coaching is not about going back to trying to understand, right? It's
right.
like, let's
right,
take
right.
where you are now. So the what you just pointed out around, it made you more coachable. It made you coachable because the soil was now fertile to be able to, you know, be watered and let the plants grow versus
that's
like,
right.
no, we got to do, you know, we got to kind of go back and figure out why the soil is the way it is and do some retribution from back there.
Yeah. And that is also that improvisation is like coaching. Improvisation is about being present in the moment, not lingering in the past, not lingering in the future, because all we have is what's in front of us.
I love that. But
yeah. And it's a great tool if you can do that,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes people can't.
Right.
I think this is maybe a great place to actually define belief, which mm-hmm. you do well in the book, because I think it means many different things to many different people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different definitions. I try to simplify things, quite frankly, a lot of times for myself. I'm a pretty simple girl. I need things broken down for me. And so when I think about beliefs, what they really are the stories or assumptions or interpretations that we make of what is presented in front of us. And so the fact of the matter is that everything that we see, if you and I are looking at the same thing, Kelly, we might believe something very different about it that is not based on what is actually in front of us, but is more grounded in what our past experiences have been, right? And so the belief, what I love about it is that it's actually quite malleable. And I liken it to an assumption that you put into a spreadsheet, for example, or a budget. Mm-hmm. You know, do we actually know that that assumption is going to be come true? No, we don't, right? But we are making our best informed choice around that assumption. But that assumption, if you choose one assumption over another, it can completely drive to a different outcome. And so I find that with leaders, which is, you know, the area that I focus on, when we think about what that last mile of potential is that they have, it truly is around what they believe, right? What assumptions are they bringing to the table in any given situation? And is that assumption actually aligned with the outcomes that they want to achieve?
So a study I love that you include in this section is Aaliyah Crumb's work mm-hmm. that she did around the study of hotel mm-hmm. room attendants and this idea of, do they work out?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's Aaliyah Crumb and Ellen Langer as well, who were both involved in that study. And I loved it too. It was eye-opening for me, right? And so what they did is, you know, you're familiar with it, is they looked at these hotel room attendants who are doing physical labor all day long, every day. I mean, I've seen them, you've seen them.
Yep.
And I've had people in my family who are those types of hotel room attendants. And they asked them, do you consider the work that you do exercise? And most of them said, no, it's just my job. It's work. And so what they introduced is the notion that their work, the work that they were doing, was actually exercise. Ask them to change nothing else. Just think about your work as exercise. Believe that it's exercise. And what they saw is that 4 weeks later, with only that change, they saw a significant enough improvement in a bunch of different health metrics in those individuals who had taken on that assignment. The only thing that changed is what they thought about the work that they did. And so the conclusion is that if you want to see a change in outcomes, you not only have to change the behavior, the action, which is what we tend to focus on, but it would also be incredibly helpful and probably more sustainable if you also change how you think about what it is that you do. So, and that is the belief. What you think about what you do is as significant for your outcomes as what it is that you do.
So in a second, we're going to start talking about some of these specifics, but chapter two is about how to get out of your own way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things this comes up in so many different books that I read across business psychology, naming something, mm-hmm. the power of actually, you know, Pennebaker's got writing it down, but I think it's a very naming it. So
yeah,
you bring that up. And I think that, I mean, really the book is about trying to find a name for all these things, because that's the only way you can have, otherwise it's like, what is it?
What is it, right? It's like, it's just out there. And look, I mean, when we talk about the power of naming, that's for anyone. Why do we get named as individuals?
You know? That's
like,
right.
I mean, thank God my parents didn't just leave me nameless, although sometimes I wish they had and I could have just picked my own. But that's a story for another day. You know, when you name something, you acknowledge it, right? That's what really naming is. Now, I say name it, but name it loosely, because it could also be something else. And so part of the point with naming the belief is, I think much of what I've read and the research I've done has been around personality styles and archetypes, which again focuses on the action. But if we really want to understand the action and the behavior, you also have to understand the belief behind it, right? The belief that's supporting it. And that's what I was really trying to get to here. Not just what are the actions that you're following that's leading to a certain outcome, but what's the behavior that's driving the action? I'm sorry, what's the belief that's driving the action? And let's pinpoint that. And I wasn't sure, you know, to your point around being curious, I wasn't sure if there were going to be common ones. But lo and behold, when I looked across my client base, I recognized, nobody's that special. There are some pretty common beliefs that get in the way of leaders being able to do their job as effectively as they would like.
All right, so let's jump into one. Chapter three, I mm-hmm. need to be involved. We meet Alex, who's a CFO of a reputable investment management firm, and he had basically no time in the day to do the things he wanted to do.
Nope. And yet, mm-hmm. he was like, I took this job because I want to do the, you know, very highly important strategic work, but I have no time. Because, you know, when we broke it down, you know, the belief that was driving him having no time was not because of everybody else, but more because he really thought he needed to be involved in everything. And so there was this quiet voice that had very loud consequences around him needing to be involved. And when he recognized that, which with some resistance, right? But when he recognized that where his level of engagement across the board, it didn't matter if it was, you know, weighing in on somebody sending an email to attending a board meeting, he just was all in 150%. And, you know, quite frankly, it just became a sheer physical capacity issue at the level at which he was leading and what his mandate was. There was no way he could physically be involved in all of the things that he typically had wanted to be and wanted to continue being.
Across the board, delegation, trust, allowing mistake to happen, things like that. That's really hard for a certain subset of people. Mm-hmm. And you talk about in the chapter, this is really where like intentions and actions have a bit of that friction because, you know, you're thinking, well, my intentions with this are completely noble. I want to, and it doesn't matter because the action is stuff's not getting done that needs to get done.
People have
no sense of autonomy, which is so crucial in the workplace. Yeah.
That's right. And look, you know, and I mean, in Alex's case, as in will be the case with all the protagonists that we're about to look at, as it was the case for me, it's not that belief I need to be involved is bad. It just doesn't serve him well now. At one point in his career, it definitely served him, right? I mean, I remember when I was an individual contributor, my first job out of college, you know, I worked at an insurance company and my responsibility was literally, I'm going to date myself here, but my responsibility was making sure that those little bill stuffers with the little messages on them had the right little message and that it got in that bill every month so that when those policyholders got their bill, they'd get something that said, you know, buy auto insurance as well as home insurance. You know, this was pre-text messages.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I needed to be involved, but there wasn't much to be involved in. You know, so yes, I needed to be involved in all the things that were under my umbrella. But as you scale and you're not only managing others, but you're managing others who manage others and the world has become more complex, there's no way you can keep that as the operating system or the operating script that then drives how you behave as a leader. If in effect, what you want to do is operate at a higher level and at a more strategic level.
I mean, you talk about that in your own experience. The idea of ceding control was a real tough thing for you to do because you were also rewarded for success in these areas.
For sure.
But it was probably unsustainable at a certain point because you can't go it alone.
I mean, I share the story for me that, you know, and look, my superpower, and it kind of still a little bit is, but I'm much more conscious of it. But like, Kelly, for a large part of my life, right? Like my superpower was being able to get a lot of stuff done, right? I just had a very high threshold, capacity threshold of being able to get things done and kind of make it look easy, right? But then I hit the same wall. And for me, that wall was when I had kids,
right? Yeah.
And I remember just, you know, I share this story. I remember kind of wanting to be involved in every little thing. Not only was I running my business, I now had these two kids because, of course, the universe gave me twins to test me. And, you know, we had a caregiver who was helping us with the kids, but I wanted to be involved. Even if I wasn't there, I wanted to be involved in everything. Like, tell me what time they do this, that, at spreadsheets, blah, blah, blah. And one day she said, which was the heart of it, right? She said, people think that if they are involved in everything, that nothing bad will happen. Kids will teach you that's not the case. And I'll be honest, I remember she sort of said it out of the side of her breath. And I kind of was like, you know, do I really want to keep this person around? But she was absolutely right.
Yeah,
you know,
that's wise.
At the end of the day, same with Alex, the protagonist in that chapter. When we really boiled it down, what was driving this belief of I need to be involved, which is control, which is rooted in wanting to feel safe, was this notion of if I'm not involved, all hell's going to break loose, which was not true, which was not founded, right?
No.
And so it's when we start understanding it from that perspective, the stories on top of the stories on top of the stories that we kind of make up or that are not valid in this current situation that aren't serving us well, that's where we start getting somewhere.
Yeah, because you dramatically grow your sphere of power, influence, control, the more you give it up to people who know, trust, and respect you.
That's right.
You've got an
army.
That's right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, so chapter five was very, it hit hard. We got hired once, and I've told this story a few times. It's actually in my book, Yes And. We got hired by a non-for-profit. It was a museum here in town, and it was a collaboration workshop we were supposed to do, but it was really for one dude. And it was like a high-level dude who needed to be right about everything and was like, and was impossible to work with. And I'll just say this, it didn't work. Like, it was probably the wrong approach anyway, but it was also like, our way didn't work. So this is Philip, senior VP of technology for a well-funded, growing startup. So
yeah,
talk about this guy.
Yeah. You gotta love Philip. I mean, I have.
No, you don't. I mean, I know you've got love for all your babies. But.
I do. I have a soft spot in my heart for the Philips of the world, and they fundamentally believe that they are right. Right? Yeah. So what is going on, when you see the Philip, and we've all been with them, right? They're the ones in the meetings that are like, the minute you start talking, they're like, got it. Or they're rolling their eyes, they're leaning back in their chair, they're kind of sighing in exacerbation, which, by the way, I have done all these things. I hate to admit it, but I have done them. But the voice that's going on, a very quiet voice, sometimes very loud, is saying to them, Philip, you know you're right. Like, speed this along. Why are we talking about this for the 10th time, the 20th time? You know the answer. Give them the answer, right? And they want to do what's right. Right? They often see that the reason why they are rushing to give the answer, the reason why they are talking over people or interrupting them so we can just get to the bottom line, is because they want to do what's right for the business, right? So why are we wasting time going around in circles? Where they miss the boat, and this is where this belief really gets in their way, is that, again, in a leadership context, your job is not just to be right. Yeah. Your job is also to build capacity on your team so that they can get to answers. Your job is also to get buy-in from the rest of your organization, aka your peers. That's where I ran into issues when I, you know, really had to face up against some of my own challenges as a leader. And so this, I know I'm right, is very tricky because you've been conditioned to be right, particularly in schooling. And then particularly, especially if you come up in sort of a technical type of role in your career, but now all of a sudden you're a leader and that's not how you define success anymore, right? It's a tough one to work through, because they're unwilling to face the consequences of what if everyone else gets it wrong.
We had Colin Fisher on the podcast recently, and he studies effective teams. He's also a former jazz improviser, so there's a lot of improv stuff. But one of the things he talks about is one of the most dysfunctional sort of work environments that makes no sense based on the science are orchestras, where you have people with incredible domain expertise who are all beholden to a single guy with a stick. And this like interplay is just so funny to think of. And when he did research, he's like, you know, this actually, there weren't conductors in the way that we understand them now from Mozart in the Jungle. And like that only happened when composers actually started conducting their own pieces because they knew how they were supposed to go. Yeah. And I said, you know, like all these dynamics that exist in the workplace is like, there is such strong place for domain expertise where you want it. And it is keenly different from, I'll call it good conducting or coaching or leading.
Yeah.
And all of that has to intersect. And it demand, you know, at Second City, we talk about ensembles where, you know, there's, yes, the director is in charge of the show, but the director understands that the show only happens with the writer performers doing their work and the stage manager turning on the lights and the audience coming in. So many different hands are involved. And if you're not allowing yourself to see that none of this would get done if the network didn't That's work. Right.
Yep.
You're messing up.
Yeah. I mean, it's so contextual too, right? I actually think that this particular belief, I know I'm right, is what's causing a lot of the intergenerational divide at work.
Yeah.
I'm a Gen Xer and Same. My kids are Gen Zs, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know what my kids have that I certainly didn't have at their age? They are young adults, you know, almost 20. They have agency.
Right? And boundaries.
I did not. So, you know what? When I had a leader who had the belief, I know I'm right, I wanted them to be right. I was like, I'm going to follow. It was command and control, right? Yeah, like I'm falling in line. I believe because I don't believe in myself. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in any choices. I don't even believe I can make a decision. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you're leading this generation now who have been taught and raised to be able to, you know, not that they're necessarily always getting it, but they believe that they have choice, that they have decision, that they have agency. If you want to motivate them, you're not going to motivate them by resisting that and coming in with that type of belief. You've got to flip the script a little bit and say, I know I can be right and I have to engage others in getting to the answer, right? Or I can believe that many people can have the answer beyond myself. So it's not letting go of the knowledge that you have. It is expanding it to understand that you may not be the sole source of knowledge, nor should you necessarily be the person driving to the answer.
In this chapter, you make reference to single and double loop learning, mm-hmm. which I hadn't come across before. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah. So this is a, I remember the title of this article that where I read about this for the first time was called, I can't remember exactly, but it was something like, Why Teaching Smart People How to Learn is Hard, or something like that. And do you want to know the first time I saw that article? They gave it, I don't know if they gave it to us or somehow I came across it my first year at Harvard Business School.
Wow.
Right? Which was kind of tough, right? Because you're like, well, obviously you come in there and you're like, I'm smart. And but you're also being told that you're difficult, right? And why? Mm-hmm. Because smart people had been conditioned to have the answer. They tend to look at single loop, meaning single loop means they just look at one form of data that comes in, that informs them, that helps get them to the answer. Double loop actually says, hey, I'm not just going to look at what's going on the outside. I'm also going to look at what's going on the inside, which is where your biases may come into play. Your assumptions may come into play. Your own projection may come into play, which may be coloring the way that you get to an answer and coloring even your ability to learn, right? And so double loop is where you actually start learning because you open yourself up to possibilities, whereas single loop creates a very narrow purview, which is really what Carol Dweck was talking about when she talks about a fixed mindset.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right. One more composite I want to talk about mm-hmm. is I Can't Make a Mistake, this chapter six. Mm-hmm. Kristen, who is the SVP of the commercial division of a company that was going through a giant upheaval. Mm-hmm. There was financial impropriety where her boss and the CEO and the CFO were all ousted and she took over. This mm-hmm. is a person who is fairly well liked, but
absolutely. Absolutely. And so she was really sort of facing having to deal with the repercussions of mistakes that had not been hers, okay, mm-hmm. Where the organization was left just in a disastrous place, lack of trust, et cetera. And she'd spent a year trying to kind of, when I coached her, we sort of labeled it as like, you are giving this organization a big, fat, warm, comforting hug after they have been through trauma, right?
Yeah.
And so she was really focused on making sure that the sins of her predecessors were not repeated. But it held her a bit hostage because what it kept her from was making decisions. And she didn't recognize that in her effort to not make a mistake, not repeat the mistake or make any mistakes with the organization, it was keeping her from actually taking the organization forward by putting a stake in the ground. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, again, very well liked because she was personable. She was taking care of everyone, but that started backfiring a little bit, because what they also needed from her was her ability to put a stake in the ground and set direction and keep it moving and take the responsibility of making decisions. And so her having to own that and recognize that disbelief was getting in her way. And by the way, not in just this situation, it was showing up in other areas as well, but had been rewarded in other situations, made her then look at it and say, okay, I've got to sort of think about this more expansively, which is we're going to do the best that we can with what we have. Right.
And why would you give her a jar of marbles?
Oh my gosh, that jar of marbles. Okay. So I have to say, none of what I do, even when you read in the book, right? I have all these little exercises that sometimes I do with my clients. If they're a game, like I can't give that. Like if I had given Philip a jar of marbles, he would have thrown them at you.
Yes, exactly.
He would have been like, what the hell are you doing? No, you're fired. Right?
Yes.
So I definitely meet the client where they are. Okay. You know, Kristen was playful. She was game. She was willing to kind of do this. So I gave her a set of marbles. So she became aware of, cause I didn't know either, right? Of how prevalent this belief of I can't make a mistake came up for her. It was a hypothesis. I wasn't sure if it bore out or not. And so every time I said, look, every time you feel this thought coming on or you feel it, put a marble in the jar. Okay. And every day we're going to take a picture and we're going to see like how many marbles are in there, which was hilarious because on the second day she like took out some marbles because she wasn't sure if she was doing the exercise correctly. And I was like, well, perfect. There we go. Right. Yeah. Like wherever you are, there you are. And so the marbles were, and it doesn't have to be marbles. It could be anything. You can tick something off of a sheet or whatnot. But what it does is again, name, make it visual, make it real, take it outside of yourself so that you can actually see the belief in real form of what you're working with. And you can recognize it, you know, because, and recognize it is again, not to blame it. It's so that you can cozy up to it, befriend it so that, because you're not getting rid of it. You're just saying, hey, I need you to just sit over there for a little bit because you're not helping me right now. And look, anybody will do that much more nicely if they're spoken to as a friend rather than beat over the head. And so that's what we're trying to do with it. We're trying to simplify it. And that's what the marbles represented.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. But one of the things that is a thread through the whole book, and you bring it up at the end, and I think it's just so important, especially where we sit today writ large, mm-hmm. the ability to have grace for each other and grace for yourself. Because we're in a deficit. Mm-hmm. We're not treating ourselves well. We're not treating others well. We're not taking a beat. We're not recognizing the complexity, the context, the shifting winds, all of it. Mm-hmm. And it's really, and then we're subject to a social media reality, which by the way, guys, not a reality. It's not real life out there. No, it's not. It's people who are very different That's behind right. a keyboard than they are when they're, mm-hmm. you know, meeting us in Starbucks or wherever. Mm-hmm. So I just want you to talk a little bit about, because I feel like you've got a very, you've worked in these business environments. You are not afraid of hard work or hard conversations. And yet there's a generosity and a grace that I think you're asking for that will allow us to do this work maybe even more successfully.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the work that I do, and thank you for describing it that way, because I probably don't see myself as that, and yet others do. And so I have to sort of get aligned with it. I think it's been a progression for me as well, you know? And I think that, when I work with clients, one of the things that I try to bring to the coaching is to, you know, in a way it sounds a little crass, but I tell them all the time, I'm like, you're actually not that special, right? Like, mm-hmm. there are a lot of other people going through stuff. There are a lot of people going through the same thing you're going through. And let's sort of keep it in perspective. Let's keep it lightly, right? And that is something very hard for them to do. But when they can start seeing that, they start being more open and they start seeing more possibilities. And by the way, I'm a business case type of person. Here's my business case for that. Like, how can you thrive with innovation? How can you respond to market forces? How can you deal with the complexity that you have to deal with as a leader if you can't be more open and allow for different options and different possibilities? So that is my total business case for it, right? That you cannot keep this rigid approach And still be able to really fulfill the potential of your business and your organization. The math just isn't mathing. Yeah. And so, you know, that's why I come about it in that way. And quite frankly, I also, you know, I'm a big believer in the, and I share it in the book, the story of the double arrows, the two arrows that Buddha, you know, shared, which is the first arrow is the pain of life, the things that are going to happen, the challenges. As a leader, the challenges don't go away. Like if a client comes, I'm like, look, the challenges, I'm not that magical. The challenges will not go away. But the second arrow, which is the one that's most painful, is how you respond to those challenges. And so I feel like all of my work is to try to minimize that second arrow with my clients so that they can lead with a little more ease. Because by gosh, if leaders could lead and experience leadership with a little more ease, man, would the world be a little bit easier for the rest of us?
Absolutely. All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Oh, boy. A yes and. So I told you I'd probably change what it is, and I have.
Right.
You know, my yes and, the big one that I've sort of been traveling for the past couple of years is a result of when my mom passed away. And I felt for a long time I had to choose, right? I could either be sad or I could be happy. You know, I could be grieving or I could be joyous, and the two could not coexist. And I remember one day, I love being outside, and I remember being one day where it was raining, but the sun was out at the same time. And what came to me was, wait a minute, Muriel. Like the two can coexist. You can be grieving and experience grief and sadness with your mom having passed away and still experience moments of joy. And that is actually what it means to experience a full life. And so to me, that was the moment I said, yes, and right.
Yeah,
that it did not have to be black or white, or one could not exist without, or one can exist, but the other can't exist. That I actually had enough capacity within me to be able to experience both pain and joy at the same time. And I then went on to sort of have applied that to a number of different areas in my work and my life, et cetera.
I don't think that's a lesson that you learn unless you experience that hurt.
Mm.
I mean, that's when we lost our daughter, Nora, to cancer 7 years ago. She was 17.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And it was the worst. And yet this keynote I gave this morning, I tell Nora stories, man, and they're funny and they get laughs and they are true and they're important. And they're about what it means to sort of be alive. And, you know, of course I'm sad and I don't want that to have happened. And yet we've got a son we're going to see next week. He's acting in McBee down in Atlanta. He's a Shakespeare actor. And there's so much, you know, like, and we talked about this before in the podcast. It's not like in the year of our Lord 10/7/2025 that in DC where you are, in Chicago where I am, everything's all rosy.
Right.
It's not.
Right.
There are troops on the streets. There are people are talking past each other. There's all of that. And yet also, like, could not have been more beautiful this weekend in terms of walk around. So walking and I think we do a disservice to other people who are in pain or vulnerable or need our help or whatever, if we don't understand the need to hold both, that
that's
it's not an either or.
That's
hard
right.
lesson. Hard
that's
lesson.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I loved our conversation. The book is called Leadership Unblocked: Break Through the Beliefs That Limit Your Potential. Muriel Wilkins, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kelly. This was such a pleasure.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.